Good morning, Severn. How are we? Welcome aboard. My name is Ryan, and I would like to welcome you to week 3 out of our 4-week series from the book of Nehemiah. If you're hopping in for the first time today, this series has one purpose, one aim, one goal. This is all about helping you find and accomplish God's will for your life. And every teaching in this series really builds off the one that came before it, so I'm just going to real quickly kind of recap what we've covered so far. And so if you're hopping in for the first time, you're not going to feel like you're missing anything. Nice little refresher course. So week 1 of this series was designed to answer the question, really the first question that needs to be answered if you want to accomplish God's will for your life, which is, how do I find God's will for my life? Can't accomplish it if you can't find it. So we answered that question by looking at the beginning of the story found in Nehemiah. And the way that this story begins is with a man named Nehemiah receiving a report about his hometown in Jerusalem. Nehemiah was a Jew, but he was born in Persian captivity about 1,000 miles away from Jerusalem. And the report that he heard was that the people, his countrymen, were living in a constant state of shame and disgrace because the wall around Jerusalem was still broken down and had been that way for about 140 years. When Nehemiah heard that news, the very first thing he did was just weep and sob really uncontrollably. And so he took this burden to God and he prayed. He talked to God about it for about 5 months, just seeking God for wisdom and direction and counting on God to open a door, which is exactly what God did. Because Nehemiah was professionally employed as the cupbearer to the king of Persia, which meant he kind of had a direct line of access to the king. And so one day he was standing in the presence of the king, very burdened by this thing that God had laid on his heart. The king could see that Nehemiah was physically affected by it, and he asked Nehemiah what was wrong, and he said, hey, why shouldn't I feel this way when things are still so bad back home for my people? And incredibly, the king of Persia stooped so low as to ask his cupbearer, what do you want to do about it? How can I help? And so Nehemiah shot his shot, and he said, I want to go to Jerusalem myself and solve this problem with my own two hands. That was the first thing that we looked at in this series. That was week 1, and that teaching was really designed to answer the question, how do I find God's will for my life? Week 2 of this series, which was also last week of this series, answered the next logical question, which is, what are my next steps once I found God's will? And again, we answered that question just by looking at everything Nehemiah did in response to this burden that God laid on his heart. How, first off, he clearly defined his mission. Secondly, he carefully made his plans. Thirdly, he honestly counted the cost. And then fourthly and finally, he boldly asked for help. Adverb, verb, noun. Flows beautifully. Preaches itself. So we're going to pick up there where we left off. And what we see is that after making this 1,000-mile journey from Jerusalem, from Susa in the Persian Empire all the way to Jerusalem, Nehemiah has now cast his vision, he's rallied the troops, and after all these months of front-end preparation, he's finally ready to begin the work that God has called him to. But what we're going to see in this passage, and I'm in Nehemiah 4, what we're going to see is the obstacles that Nehemiah experienced as he began walking in obedience to God's call in his life. And with that, we're going to see how he handled them. So week 1's teaching answered the question, how do I find God's will? Last week answered the question, what do I do once I've found it? This week, we're going to answer the question, what obstacles will I experience as I begin walking in God's will for my life? So maybe that's where you find yourself today. Maybe you have some kind of idea of what it is that God's calling you to do, but it'd be really nice if you knew kind of what's on the horizon for you. Good news is that is the question that this story is going to answer very specifically. I think this is probably going to be one of the most relatable parts of this series for people, because what you're going to see is the obstacles that Nehemiah faced are obstacles that are completely common to the human experience. I can promise you this, you're either dealing with what Nehemiah was dealing with or you're getting ready to. So here's the question. What obstacles should we experience as we begin doing what it is that God's called us to do? There's actually 3 answers to that question in Nehemiah's life. The first answer to that question is going to be our first idea today, and it is this: criticism that tears at you. Let's pick it up in Nehemiah chapter 4, verses 1 through 3. It says, when Sanballat, who is the bad guy, heard that we were rebuilding the wall, he became furious. He mocked the Jews before his colleagues and the powerful men of Samaria and said, what are these pathetic Jews doing? Can they restore it by themselves? Will they offer sacrifices? Will they ever finish it? Can they bring these burnt stones back to life from the mounds of rubble? Then Tobiah the Ammonite, who was beside him, this is the sidekick, said, and this is the worst insult in the history of humanity, indeed, even if a fox climbed up what they are building, he would break down their stone wall. Sick burn, Tobiah. Really well done. So the first thing that Nehemiah experienced is, as he walked in obedience to the call that God placed on his life, is criticism. Anybody here ever been criticized? Not us. I hate criticism. The good news is there is one way that you and I can avoid criticism. Aristotle is actually credited with saying this. You didn't know we were going to get all philosophical today, but here's a quote from Aristotle. He said, "The only way to avoid criticism is to say nothing, do nothing, and be nothing." That's all you got to do if you don't want to be criticized. Nehemiah refused to do that. He refused to ignore this burden that God laid on his heart. And sure enough, the very first obstacle that he experienced was criticism. And you and I should expect the same. So what that means for us today, living in 2019, is that if you're listening to this, and maybe you're not yet a follower of Jesus, maybe you haven't yet pulled the trigger and made that decision, but you are seeking, you are investigating, you are pursuing this, or maybe if you're listening to this, you've already done that, but you've made the decision to take your walk with God to the next level, either by repenting of something that God's calling you out of or by pursuing a calling that God's placed on your life that is going to have you leaving your old life behind. What Nehemiah's life should cause you and I to know, to be sure of, is that criticism is in our near future. Anybody who's ever even attempted to do anything for God has experienced criticism by people who stood on the sidelines and either couldn't or didn't feel like trying to understand it. What I love about Nehemiah, his response here, the way that he handled it, is that he didn't do what so many people often do in the face of criticism. He didn't get all defensive. He didn't try to defend himself. He didn't try to reason with his critics. It just says in verses 4 and 5 that he prayed. That's how he handled criticism. I think it was during week 1 of this series, that if you don't believe that prayer is a necessary part of your life, that the life of Nehemiah would challenge that belief. He prayed for 5 months, Nehemiah did, before he did anything in this story. The moment before he went public with this burden that God laid on his heart, he prayed. And here he is at the very first sign of opposition praying. At all these pivotal moments in Nehemiah's life, the common denominator among them is that in each one of those moments, he can be found talking to God about what's going on in his life. So here's what it says in verse 6. It says, "So we rebuilt the wall until the entire wall was joined together up to half its height, for the people had the will to keep working." So criticism in and of itself was not a big enough obstacle to deter Nehemiah and all the men and women that had given their lives and invested themselves into this good work. And so what happens in this story is that Nehemiah then goes on to experience another incredibly common obstacle that people experience when they begin doing what it is that God has called them to do. And it's the second thing we're going to talk about this morning. Number 2, it's fear that paralyzes you. You pick it up in verse 7. It says, "When Sanballat, Tobiah, and the Arabs, Ammonites, and Ashdodites," so this is now a large group of people, it says, "when they heard that the repair to the walls of Jerusalem was progressing and that the gaps were being closed, they became furious. They all plotted together to come and fight against Jerusalem and throw it into confusion." Skip down to verse 11. It says, "And our enemy said, they won't know or see anything until we're among them and can kill them and stop the work. When the Jews who lived nearby arrived, they said to us time and again, everywhere you turn, they attack us." So criticism turned into actual threats for Nehemiah and his band of workers. And now he's dealing with another incredibly common obstacle that people who walk in obedience to God's call deal with, and that's fear. Fear that would paralyze us. Fear that would have us really stop right where we are in our tracks. I got a text message from a friend of mine this week who it's very clear to me that God's working in their life in some capacity. They texted me and said, beyond shadow of a doubt, they are crystal clear that God is calling them to do something different, to do something in light of what God has done for them. And their first words were, "and I'm terrified about it." It's an incredibly common experience. It's not a bad thing. A lot of times what that indicates is just that you're really serious about what it is that God's calling you to. And whatever form, whatever place that fear comes from, everybody's going to experience to one degree or another. For a lot of us, it's the fear of failure. I was listening to a sermon one time by a guy named Rick Warren who was talking about failure versus the fear of failure. And he said that failure in and of itself really isn't that bad because it's really failure is one of the greatest teachers that there is. Right, like maybe you've heard that quote from Thomas Edison where he was asked about all these failures on his way to inventing the light bulb. He said, I haven't failed. I just found 10,000 ways that don't work, 10,000 ways to not do what it is that I'm trying to do. And that's what failure is. It's just an education. It's a valuable thing. But the fear of failure is a really dangerous thing because the fear of failure will keep us from ever doing anything at all. And a lot of people are just terrified to move in the direction that God has called them to move in, and to really invest all of themselves in what they know in their heart of hearts God's calling them to, because in their mind, their thought process is, well, if I invest every part of myself in this, and then it doesn't work out, then I haven't just failed, I am a failure. And they can't live with that. They wouldn't be able to look themselves in the mirror. What I've seen in my own life and in the lives of other people is that the enemy will use that mindset to keep people on the bleachers instead of on the field where God's calling them. If it's not that kind of fear, another really common form of fear that people experience is fear that kind of presents itself as doubt that just whispers to us and says, hey, maybe this really isn't where God has you. And maybe you made this up. And maybe the reason that things are getting so hard and so difficult and there's so much opposition is because this was never really God's idea to begin with. And I guarantee you that Nehemiah in chapter 4, I guarantee that that's what he was dealing with. You know, one thing that really stood out to me as I was thinking about this story is that if you go back to chapter 2, after Nehemiah has just got done praying for 5 months about this burden that God laid on his heart, and he's getting ready to tell the king about it, really interesting detail in this story, Nehemiah himself says, I had never been sad in front of the king before. And then the story continues, and it says, when the king noticed that his cupbearer was sad, it was so noteworthy to him. It so caught him off guard that he kind of stopped everything and said, Nehemiah, you're sad. What's going on here? Now, I read that, and I just think that's an interesting detail, because if you're the king of Persia, you have more than a few things occupying your mind at any given time. But for it to be that noteworthy that Nehemiah doesn't have a smile on his face really tells me one thing. Nehemiah had a pretty good life. Because I don't know about you, I've gone to work sad a few times in my career as a pastor. Maybe you wake up with butterflies in your stomach on Monday mornings. It's not the case for everybody, all right? And so I'm convinced that when Nehemiah here is experiencing all this opposition and these setbacks and now these large groups of people against him, you can be sure that the enemy was all up in his mind saying, hey, Nehemiah, you want to know why you're facing criticism? You want to know why it's starting to feel like the world's against you and with every step you take, it's two steps back? Here's why. It's because this isn't God's will for your life. And you need to stop, turn around, go back to where you came from before you wind up losing more than just your reputation. That is an incredibly common thing that the enemy will use just to deter us, to keep us from living the life that God's calling us to live. And so these are the first two obstacles that Nehemiah dealt with that we should be on the lookout for, criticism and fear. But what these two things often lead to is another kind of obstacle that is far more dangerous than either of the first two. This is going to be our third idea this morning. It's discouragement that sabotages you. What all of this led to, this criticism and these threats, what it led to is this condition we read about in chapter 4, verse 10. It says, in Judah, it was said, the strength of the laborer fails since there's so much rubble. We will never be able to rebuild the wall. So what happened there is that all of these external attacks coming from other people started to impact Nehemiah and his workers internally to the point that it used to be critics standing on the outside of their life, lobbying threats and lobbying their opinions. But now in Judah, it was Nehemiah and the rest of the workers that were beginning to say, maybe we can't do this. Maybe this isn't really going to happen. Now, my conviction is that discouragement is a far more dangerous thing to you and I than either criticism or fear. And to explain why I believe that, I want to talk about something that I learned back in the Fire Academy. In the Fire Academy, we took a class. I think it was only like a half-day class, but it was a class about smoke reading. And the goal of the class was to teach us to know kind of where a fire was located and how advanced it was just by looking at the way that smoke was leaving the building. And I still remember a lot of what they taught us even today. For instance, if you roll up on location to a house fire and it's got light gray smoke that's just kind of wafting from the house, you know that that fire is in its incipient stages. If you have to go into a burning building, that's the time to do it because the fire is not very advanced, so it's not going to be that hot and visibility is not going to be that bad. However, if you see a lot of thick black smoke, that means that the fire is advanced. That's what you'd call a room and contents fire, something like a mattress or a couch or a Christmas tree is on fire. That environment is going to be a lot less friendly. It's going to be a lot hotter and a lot less visibility, and it can get so bad that you can't even see your hand in front of your face. Matter of fact, it can get so dark that it's too dark to even see the fire you're trying to put out. That's not a good place to be. They also told us that smoke will behave a certain way depending on how close it is to the fire. So for instance, if you pulled up to a split foyer and the whole second floor was on fire and there's smoke blowing out the windows, if it's blowing a lot more forcefully out of just one of those windows, that's a good chance that that's where the seat of your fire is. But they said that there's one type of smoke that you absolutely never want to see, and that's light brown smoke. Which when I first heard, I was trying to think if I had ever seen light brown smoke, and I can't think of a time in my life when I had. The reason they said you never want to see light brown smoke is because of what it indicates. The only time you're ever going to see it is when a large amount of untreated wood is burning. And the only place in a home that you're going to see a large amount of untreated wood is behind the walls of that home, the studs, the trusses, the structural members of the home. When that happens and you start to see light brown smoke there, unless you are positive that there's somebody in there that you need to rescue, there's almost no reason to go into that house. It's on the verge of collapsing. I've heard of a lieutenant that pulled up on scene and saw light brown smoke and instantly, just without even thinking about it, called everybody out. That's how serious they take this. And the way that they describe a home in that condition is they say that the structural integrity of the home has been compromised. That's the specific phrase they use, the structural integrity of the home. And I thought that was so interesting to use the word integrity when talking about just a structure. But when they did that, it was almost like a light came on for me. And that was the first time that I felt like I really began to understand the concept or the idea of integrity. Because when you're using that term to talk about a house fire, saying that a house no longer has structural integrity, what you're really saying is that house no longer has the ability to stand up under its own weight. So with that definition in mind, all integrity really is, it's your and my ability to continue standing. And this whole the reason I tell all this is because it's what fire behind the walls does to a home is really it's a picture-perfect analogy of what discouragement does in the life of a person. See, I don't know anybody that really likes being criticized. It's not a fun thing to experience. I don't really know anybody that likes experiencing fear. But to be perfectly honest, those things just aren't really all that dangerous to us. For one reason, they come from the outside, just like they did in this story. Discouragement is a different animal altogether. It's far more deadly to us. For just one reason, because it comes from inside of us. And like fire behind the walls of a home, it sabotages our structural integrity. And if something isn't done about it sooner rather than later, then eventually we're going to lose our ability to stand. I heard somebody say one time, speaking of discouragement, that they said the greatest test of our strength is found in what it takes to discourage us. And I used to believe that, but I don't anymore. And the reason I don't believe that is because I look through this book time after time, the people that God has called and used, and one common denominator between almost all of them is that every one of them dealt with very serious seasons of discouragement. Two people that immediately come to mind for me are Moses and Elijah. Moses and Elijah, you know, they represent really the law and the prophets in the Old Testament. That's why it's not a coincidence that they were standing on either side of Jesus during his transfiguration. Moses and Elijah were men that I don't really know that anybody has ever been used more powerfully than them. These were men that, you know, with their words, they would call down plagues. You know, they'd call down fire from heaven, consume the false prophets. These were men that, you know, walked into the presence of God. Moses had to wear a veil because he was glowing at the end of it. Everybody was so terrified of just seeing him. And you would think that those people would never have a bad day, that they'd be the most confident people on earth. But I think it's so important for us to realize that both of them, it's recorded in the Bible, that both Moses and Elijah, during the lowest points of their lives, actually asked God to end their lives. Both of them actually personally asked God in the lowest point of their life, they just said, God, just please take my life. Please end it here. I don't want to do this anymore. It's no different with King David. You read the Psalms, and it's like he's on the mountaintop one day, he's in the valley the other. And what all of those stories show me, and what this story shows me, is that the real test of our strength has nothing to do with what it takes to discourage us, and everything to do with how we respond when we're discouraged. It's got everything to do with how we respond when we feel like Nehemiah and his people did here, when we feel like maybe my marriage is never going to get fixed. Or when we feel like maybe this addiction's just always going to be a part of my life. Or maybe I just don't have what it takes to raise these kids. Or when we feel like, chapter 4, verse 10, our strength has completely failed. There's nothing left, and there's no way that I'm going to be able to do what it is that God has called me to do. I believe it's how we respond in those times that defines us. Because it's how Nehemiah responded there that defined him. Prior to this moment, prior to Nehemiah chapter 4, just to be perfectly honest, Nehemiah is an inspirational story, but it's not been one that I can relate to. Because Nehemiah has not had a single problem yet. I mean, up until this point in Nehemiah's life, it's been almost comical the way that the winds have been at his back. He prays for 5 months, and sure enough, the king is asking Nehemiah, hey, what can I do for you to help you be successful? And he's, you know, writing these laws and making sure that Nehemiah has everything he needs. He travels 1,000 miles to Jerusalem, and he casts this vision to the people, and there's no coercion, there's no struggle. He just clearly lays it out to them, and they all buy in, and he's rallied the troops, and it's like he can conquer the world. Hasn't had a problem yet in his life, but now for the very first time, in Nehemiah's life, he's got something that he hasn't had before, which is a reason to quit. And maybe, just maybe, like God so often does, maybe God's brought somebody to his house this morning that's right there. Maybe somebody listening to this has been trying to do what you know God's calling you to do, and it just feels like right now you don't have any more strength. And you've honestly begun to wonder, maybe there's no way I'm going to be able to do this thing. So here's the million-dollar question. What do you do? What do you do when you don't have the strength to do anything else? How do you respond to these kinds of things to make sure that your obstacles are not your ending? What is crystal clear to me from this story is that the only hope that you and I have, let me say that again. The only hope that you and I have when we find ourselves where Nehemiah and his people were right here in Nehemiah chapter 4, verse 10, the only hope we have is to find something bigger than our obstacles to hold on to. That's exactly what Nehemiah did. Let me read the first half of chapter 4, verse 14. Nehemiah said, after I made an inspection, I stood up and said to the nobles, the officials, and the rest of the people, don't be afraid of them. And if I was one of the people listening to Nehemiah that day, I would be asking a very important question. Why? Why shouldn't I be afraid of people that can kill me? And with the next thing that Nehemiah said, he tells him exactly why. He says, remember the great and awe-inspiring Lord. So what do you do when there are obstacles between you and the life that God is calling you to that have completely taken all the fire out of your furnace? You do exactly what Nehemiah did here. First and foremost, you remember the God who called you. If Nehemiah, I was thinking about this week, if Nehemiah's life was like a Hollywood movie, this would be the part where like some dramatic music starts to kick in, maybe like some Hans Zimmer kind of thing for my cinema fans out there, and Nehemiah would probably have some kind of really fluffy but totally useless motivational speech full of platitudes that don't really mean anything. And Nehemiah here could have said, hey guys, look at all the progress that you've made. We already got half a wall here. Who cares? Who cares how far you've come if there's people that are literally, this project could literally cost you your life. which is where they were. Nehemiah could have said, hey, remember what I told you before and remember all the doors that God's opening. Nehemiah didn't go down that road because he knew he was just a man. And he didn't say, hey, remember the king of Persia has blessed this project. Why would that matter? He's 1,000 miles away. It'd be weeks before he found out what was going on here. So the very first thing that Nehemiah did in the face of overwhelming obstacles is have himself and all the people that had dedicated their lives to this good work that God had called them to, very first thing he had them do was simply remember the God who called them. And the reason that this is so important is because the natural instinct of the human heart or the human mind or just whatever, the first thing that we tend to do when we find ourselves here is we immediately begin to place the focus on ourselves. We immediately begin to think about all the things that we need to do or all the things that we're not going to be able to do. And we start asking ourselves, can I do this? And maybe I can't do this. And whether or not we've realized that we've already made a fatal mistake there, what we've begun doing is we've compared the size of our obstacles to ourselves and our own ability. And every single time we do that, our obstacles are going to seem insurmountable. And so what Nehemiah's example is teaching us of here is that when we're faced with obstacles that we have no answer for, the most healthy thing that you and I can do is just get outside of the situation and remember the God who called us. I was reading in the Psalms this week, and it's Psalm 33, verses 6 through 9. As soon as I came across this text, I knew that this would be a perfect fit for this idea in this teaching. So I don't know who's here that really needs to have an enlarged view of God in their lives, but if that's you, if you're dealing with discouragement, if you're dealing with fear, if you're dealing with criticism, if you find yourself here, let me just ask you to just dial in here to Psalm 33 and remember the God who called you. This is what it says in Psalm 33, verse 6. The heavens were made by the word of the Lord, and all the stars by the breath of his mouth. He gathers the waters of the sea into a heap. He puts the depths into storehouses. Let the whole earth tremble before the Lord. Let all the inhabitants of the world stand in awe of him. For he spoke and it came into being. He commanded and it came into existence. Whenever I begin to read verses like that and really consider who God is, I just immediately feel like my chest cavity gets lighter. That there's a God, like just really for a second here, and I don't know what you have going on Monday through Saturday, but really consider this. The only reason that you're still breathing is because that God said so. The only reason that there is something rather than nothing is because once upon a time, he spoke. And everything and everyone is going to give an account to him. So I don't know what your obstacle is today. I don't know if it's discouragement. I don't know if it's fear. I don't know if it's critics. But here's a really healthy thing to hold on to. You and I aren't going to stand before our critics at the end of our life. We're going to stand before our Creator. And the only thing that matters between this moment and that moment is that we do what we know God has called us to. This life is a mist. It's a vapor. It appears and it vanishes. We don't even have any idea how much time we have. The only thing that matters between now and whenever the Spirit returns to God who gave it is that we do what he's called us to do. And when we drop back and we just consider who this God is, it's amazing. It doesn't change the obstacles necessarily, but it certainly makes them look a lot smaller compared to the size of the God who called us. Amen? That's the first thing Nehemiah shows us to do. But in the second half of verse 14, here's what he says. After he says, remember the great and awe-inspiring Lord, he says, and fight for your countrymen. Fight for your countrymen, your sons and your daughters, your wives and our homes. This is the second thing that you and I have got to do in the face of obstacles that we don't have an answer for. Number two, we remember what we're fighting for. The vast majority of the time, the reason that people burn out and break down and give up has very little to do with how hard their path was. And the reason I say that is because everybody's got a hard path. Life gets difficult for all of us. Life's just not an easy thing. That's why nobody makes it out of life alive. The vast majority of the time that people break down and burn out and give up goes back to one reality. They forgot why they got started in the first place. And Nehemiah understood this principle. Nehemiah understood how deadly it is when we lose sight of our purpose, lose sight of our why. And so notice here, he doesn't say, you know, fight for this wall that we're building. He says, fight for your countrymen. Fight for your sons and your daughters. Fight for your wives and your homes, because for Nehemiah, this was never about a wall. This was about something so much more than that. If you go back to the report that changed Nehemiah's life, the report that he received that set him on this trajectory, back in chapter 1, verse 3, it says, "They said to me, 'The remnant in the province who survived the exile are in great trouble and disgrace.'" That's why Nehemiah wept. That's what caused Nehemiah to pray for 5 months and have the stupidity and the audacity to stand before a king and say, "I want to do something about this." This was never about a wall for him. This was about his countrymen. This was about people. This was about the nation of God still living in a place of shame and regret and disgrace. And the wall was just a means. Building that wall was just a means to that end. It was just a what to accomplish his why. I'm going to get real personal here. In my office, I have two pictures that every once in a while, when I find myself in a Nehemiah chapter 4, verse 10 scenario, I just go back to. If you were here in Easter of 2018, we did a baptism service. And the way that we do baptisms around here, for those of you that are new, is we end the service and we have the worship team come up. And then we let everybody who's getting baptized, they just come up on this stage and they stand right here. And we give them a sign. And on one side of their sign, they just write a brief description of who they were before they met Jesus. And then they turn it around. They flip that sign around, just the way that Jesus flips people's lives around. And on the other side, it's a description of who they are now because of Jesus. And then they get in the tank and they get baptized and the crowd goes wild. And if you were here at Easter, you know exactly what I was talking about. But I have two pictures in my office that are of one particular individual that got baptized in Easter. And on the first picture, it shows the first part of his sign. And when he held it up, it just had two words. It says, "Angry and exhausted." And I remember this guy when he first started coming to Severn, and there is not a more accurate description of who he was. He was angry and he was exhausted. And frankly, he was horrifying because he's not a little guy. And I think about that, and I think about how many people in this world are angry and are exhausted. How many people that right now are outside the fold, the family of God, that have been angry and exhausted for so long that they don't even realize it anymore. But the second picture that I have is of him with his sign turned around. And on the other side of his sign, it says grateful, content, and peaceful. And the transformation that Jesus has worked in this guy's life is literally like that of Saul of Tarsus becoming Paul the Apostle. He doesn't even look the same. He's exactly as huge and horrifying, like could go toe-to-toe with Shrek, but I can give him a hug now. And I'm not even afraid to do it. But the reason that I go back to those pictures is to remind myself of why I do what I do. And just so we're all on the same page here, this isn't about preaching for me. I love to preach, but that's my what. It's not my why. Preaching is just a means to an end. And the end is to see one more person have their lives flipped around by Jesus. This whole church, this isn't about 52, 90-minute entertaining sessions on Sunday morning because we have nothing better to do. All of this is a means, because it's not even that entertaining some weeks, right? You can say amen in the house of God. This is about one thing and one thing only. It's about seeing Jesus flip somebody else's life around. That's what this is about. And it's that principle that Nehemiah is putting on display for us here. What we have got to hold on to when there's criticism, when there's fear, or when there's discouragement, we got to get outside of what we're doing, and we have to remember why we're doing it. We have to remember the calling that God has placed on our lives. Let me call the worship team up, and we're going to close this morning. In 1 Peter chapter 4, verse 12, we read this. "Dear friends, don't be surprised when the fiery ordeal comes among you to test you as if something unusual were happening to you." It's always caught my eye that the very first thing this says to do regarding the fiery ordeals of life is just don't be surprised by them. Because the vast majority of time in our lives, the problems that we have are not that we have problems, it's that we're so surprised by the fact that we have problems. We're so surprised when a fiery ordeal pops up. We're so surprised when there's a trial. We're so surprised when obedience stops being fun and opposition and obstacles rear their ugly heads. And I'm convinced that this story in Nehemiah chapter 4 was written and preserved in God's word for us so that we wouldn't have to be surprised anymore, so that we would know exactly what happens when we get serious about doing what it is that God has called us to do. And what this story should show you and I is that when we get serious about following God, we will experience criticism that tears at us. It's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. And we will experience fear that would paralyze us. It's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. And when we get serious about following hard after God, it's probably not going to be too long before we are so discouraged that we feel like we barely have the strength to stand anymore. And when you're in that place, that in and of itself is not an indicator that you're not where you should be. Sometimes it's the best indicator that you're right where God wants you to be. But what this story also shows us is how to respond when we're faced with those obstacles. And what it says, just clear as day, that you got it. The very first thing you and I have to do, we have to do, is go back to the calling that God has placed on our life. To get outside of the what, get outside of the how, and go back to our why. But even more important than that, the only thing that's going to get us through discouragement and fear and all of it, the only thing that's going to get us through that is remembering the God who called us. Remembering the great and the awe-inspiring Lord. Remember that it was God who sent his own son to destroy every obstacle between us and himself so that we could come home and find a relationship with him. So that we could find all of the love and all of the mercy and all of the satisfaction and all of the purpose that we're hardwired to need but couldn't find if not for Jesus. We remember the great and the awe-inspiring Lord. And we remember that as we live the life that he's called us to, he'll give us what we need as we go back to him time and time again. And however hard it gets, however many tears there are, however much pain it is, when we stand before him, we're going to know in that moment that it was worth it. That's it. That's all.